Blog Talk Radio.
Well, I thought my razor was dull until I heard his speech. And that reminds me of a story that's so dirty I'm ashamed to think of it myself. I don't know what they have to say. It makes no difference anyway. Whatever it is, I'm against it. No matter what it is or who commenced it, I'm against it. Your proposition may be good, but let's have one thing understood. Whatever it is, I'm against it. And even when you've changed it or condensed it, I'm against it. I'm opposed to it. On general principles, I'm opposed to it.
He's opposed to it. In fact, indeed, he's opposed to it.
For months before my son was born, I used to yell from night till morn, whatever it is, I'm against it. And I've kept yelling since I first commenced it. I'm against it.
Well, how are you this evening? Good to be with you. James Bostic here with A Conservative's Perspective on Patriot Nation Radio Network. We do this thing live a couple times a week. We do it Tuesdays and Thursdays, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We also have a show that's recorded over the weekend and is played on the Talk America Radio Network throughout the week. Big news, we've had some, you know, over the last couple shows here on Tuesdays and Thursdays, A Conservative's Perspective's educational contributor, Jo Frost, has been with us, and she has been active in the comings and goings and the doings down at the Capitol. And we had talked earlier, and the thinking was, and the hope was, that Jo would be joining us from the steps of the Capitol this evening. Didn't work out that way. We do have her with us, and I pulled her up here online. Hello, Jo Frost. How are you?
Good evening. I'm good. How are you?
Doing well, thanks. We've seen some possibly significant events take place in the last couple of hours. You want to tell us what's going on?
So it looks as if the governor and the union leadership have come to an agreement where the unions will do what the governor would like, is for the teachers and the service personnel to get back into the classroom and work with our students on Thursday after Wednesday being a cooling off period. He has agreed to a 5% annual raise for teachers and 3% for all public employees. There's still a freeze on PEIA. And the governor is assembling a task force immediately to study PEIA. So the union requests have not been fully met by any stretch of the imagination. And so the union leadership has reserved the right to call teachers back out on strike as needed if the governor does not honor what he has said he will do. And I myself and what I am seeing from the people in our building is that we feel a certain amount of skepticism that the governor will honor what he has said he will do.
Well, this sounds to me, though, when reserving the right for another work stoppage or having to engage in this again, automatically tells you that, yeah, there's probably a high level of skepticism there. However, I would think, just in the little bit of time here, that I've had to disseminate this through social media and then, of course, talking with you, confirming it, basically. In the beginning of this, the governor and the legislature were remarkably resolute in their positions. And then yet over the short span of 4 days, I'm not going to say caved, but they've been remarkably more conciliatory than they were at the beginning of this thing.
I do agree with that. Just to hear him yesterday in his town hall meetings yesterday, the governor was speaking of, he still his name yesterday, and he sat there in a public school and lit a cigar. I'm just not comfortable with a 24-hour turnaround. on the governor's part. So, you know, getting them to come to the table is a huge step because, you know, the union leadership has been in Charleston just about every day saying, come to the table, we're ready and willing, where are you? And the Senate president and House Delegates chair have not been willing to come to the table. So, you know, that is definitely a positive change from where we were a week ago. It leads to a lot of concern and a lot of disappointment.
So as it stands now, we have the implementation of these of this thing that they were trying to do with PEIA put on hiatus basically, and this commission that the governor's going to put together has 17 months to come up with some kind of viable solution to solve this problem rather than placing it, you know, on the backs of the people whom it is supposed to benefit the most.
Mm-hmm.
So given that, I'm sure that there's probably some kind of a preliminary window within that 17-month window where union leadership's going to be looking at these situations as they exist, and they're going to say, okay, we're just not seeing any momentum here. What do you think we need to do, and how would we go about using this leverage that we've reserved the right to use? What's going to be the best way to implement that?
You know, I don't know. I've talked about capping medical inflation in the past, and there's nothing that our legislators have talked about that have anything to do with capping medical inflation. I don't know that the state of West Virginia needs to be held hostage over rising medical costs, and I don't know that our public employees need to be held hostage over that. You know, that everything is bowing down to rising medical costs. So I know that PEIA, the PEIA board, has said repeatedly that they need at least $50 million every year extra in funding to meet the needs of West Virginia's aging population. The rising pharmaceutical costs coupled with rising medical costs. We have 200,000 people currently insured by PEIA, and as you know, as much as I do, West Virginia has an aging population. We're bleeding our young people out of the state as fast as we can. So I don't know what kind of recommendations can be made.
Okay, well, Joe, let's go back a minute. Now you mentioned medical cost capping, and you hear that a lot, and I'm going to go ahead and profess my ignorance on that issue just right out. What are the realities? What are the practicalities of actually implementing that kind of thing, medical capping?
My personal experience, and I'm looking that up as we speak, but my personal experience was living in Vermont, and which we know Vermont is a significantly more liberal state than West Virginia. But 20 years ago in Vermont, there was a law in the book that if you were unable to pay your medical bills, say, for instance, I was a single parent, I was self-employed at the time, and I didn't have any kind of health care coverage for myself or my family, that I could pay a one-time fee to take care of any medical needs. And so my son, we were visiting Vermont at the time, we were not living in Vermont at that point, and he broke his arm. And so I took him to the emergency room, and I paid $29 for full medical care in the emergency room in Vermont. And then when we went to cast his arm after he broke it, it was a $259 one-time fee. And I paid it in cash, and I got a receipt. And so the doctor that cast his arm didn't record the payment, and so they sent me a bill for it, and I sent them a copy of that receipt, and that was it. For a broken arm, just 1998, it was under $300 to x-ray, emergency room visit, x-ray, and cast my son's arm with follow-up appointments.
Wow. So what's going to happen now, Joe? We're going to take the day off tomorrow, and people are going to be, you know, they're going to be getting ready, getting their minds right to get back in to doing what we're supposed to be doing. And so what's going to happen now in terms with union leadership and the people they're going to have to deal with, namely the governor, but others within Charleston?
You know, it's still a political poker match. They're still holding cards, and the governor is still holding cards. And what they can do, tomorrow is crossover day, so they can get bills out of committee and vote on them in the Senate and the House and cross over to the opposing party, opposing part of the legislature. And they can suspend the rules, and they can propose new legislation that can then move fairly quickly through the legislature. And then they're also talking about calling a special session. The governor wants a right of access rule passed, so there's a specific term for that that I've forgotten. But he was disappointed that a right of access rule didn't pass, and that was a natural gas resources bill that was looking for 75% ownership approval. So, for instance, in your neighborhood, you've got, if you consider four houses in your neighborhood that are all on adjoining properties, and the three houses had signed that it was okay for natural resource removal under those homes, they had offered mine rights or mineral rights to the company, then the fourth house did not have to agree to those mineral rights. And that bill did not pass through the legislature, and Governor Justice has asked, has already requested a special session to revisit that mineral rights legislation, because he thinks that that would help with taxes and with allowing rights to the companies that are looking to take resources out of West Virginia. So he's already talked about a special session to do that, and if the legislation is not passed regarding pay raises and PEIA before the end of the regular session, that would be addressed during the special session also.
Okay, so as it stands, and I guess we'll just go ahead and sum up, unless you've got some other things that you wanted to talk about. As it stands, the governor has rethought his position and taken some things under advisement and has fundamentally agreed to what the AFT and the WBA union leadership are looking at. But at the same time, being experienced negotiators with cats like Governor Justice, AFT, WVEA, have reserved the right to bring us back out should things start to stink, right?
Correct.
Okay. All right. Well, is there anything else, Joe? I know you have really, and once again, you know, while I've got you here and know your story, because, you know, in the interest of disclosure, Joe Frost and I work at the same school. She's an outstanding coworker. I've known her for a number of years now, and she's a fine, fine person. And I know your story, and because of these things, I know your story. And your story is not unique. You're probably representative of a lot of stories concerning state employees in general, but folks in the school business. And what you have done, clearly, and I know anybody that talks about it will say, and I'll just be the first to give you your props, what you have done during this whole time of this, you know, this issue ripening and coming into, you know, resolution has been above and beyond. You have worked, you've worked tenaciously at making sure everybody had the necessary information that they needed to make the correct decisions. I know that it was a massive imposition on your life and the things that you had to do in addition to doing what you already do. And I just want to say thank you very much. All of us here at ACP are grateful for the time that you've taken to talk with us. And we look forward, may as well come back on Thursday since we're still in the vacuum of this thing and see, you know, how things went on our first day back and talk a little bit about that. If you feel like it, we would love to have you. Okay.
Well, I appreciate it. And if you don't mind, let me just read this paragraph that came up.
Sure.
Just just so you have an idea, when we're talking about medical inflation and medical trades, number one, I don't feel like it's been an imposition on my life because I want to do what's right for my colleagues. I know that in some instances I kind of have the most to lose because I'm the primary wage earner for three generations in my household. But I know that if I have the most to lose, that everybody seems to lose something. And that's what's important to me, to reach out to my colleagues because, man, what an amazing group of people we work with. Yesterday on the Capitol steps, when we're listening to the UMWA leadership and we're listening to these announcements, one of the most outstanding things was that as these teachers are standing there in Charleston, unsure if their next paycheck is coming to them, unsure about what tomorrow will bring, is that they raised $6,000 for a teacher who had been in a car accident on her way home on Friday. And so that money was going directly to her to help her with her medical care. So that was just a very powerful moment to think about all of these people who don't know what the next step is, reaching out to help each other. Just as teachers have reached out and delivered lunches to students and done what they can to help families in this community while everybody is kind of struggling with what to do with their kids tomorrow or the next day or what's going to happen. But when I'm looking at this medical inflation question, and I'm looking at Sandy Ground, San Diego Union Tribune, it talks about hospitals in San Diego County charge anywhere from $52,000 to $98,000 for a knee replacement. So if you walk in the door of one hospital in San Diego County versus walking in the door of a different hospital in San Diego County, that you could pay a $46,000 difference in the price of a knee replacement surgery. And that's the kind of question that I face when you think about what's going on in West Virginia. We don't need to bow down to these hospitals. But we want our nurses and our hospital staff to have the best pay, and we want our patients to get the best care. But can you imagine that a knee replacement is the care, the level of care is $46,000 different? Because I find that a little difficult to imagine.
Yeah, that's huge. I meant to ask you this earlier, Joe. Numbers in terms of, and I think that this was probably something that played a pretty pivotal role in what happened here over the last 4 days. And I think that it was the rapid response and organization of the unions, but of the teachers out there at the rally points, going to Charleston and staying there. How many people do you think were there today or over the last couple of days? How many people have been there?
One of the things that the number that I've been looking at, which is not the number of every person in the Capitol, is the number of people who go through the security checkpoint by about 4 p.m. each day. And the first day it was about 4,000, which was Thursday. The next day it was about 4,300. And then yesterday it was 5,300 going through the checkpoint at the Capitol by 4 p.m. And that does not include all the number of people that stand outside that could not get inside, because there's a point where when you're in the upper gallery, the fire marshal says, we can't tolerate another person coming in the building on that second floor. Even though this building is made of marble, it's still 100 years old. We don't really want to run the risk of there being another 100 people there and something cracking with this marble making this building unsafe. If people would go down, they've even said if people would go downstairs and more people would loiter downstairs, then we could have more people up there, then we could admit more people into the building. But the fire marshal, of course, wants everybody to be safe.
Right. Okay. Go ahead, Joe.
I've heard people say that, there's another 2,000 outside. And that rally yesterday with the UMWA and AFL-CIO, I would say we were close to 10,000 outside yesterday.
That's a significant statement. And speaking from someone who comes back from the time of when coal really was king in West Virginia back 35, 45 years ago and beyond, I'm trying to think of rallies in the state that had that kind of impact. And I'm having to go back to, like I said, the UMW days, when the unions were really a strong force and coal was running free in the Mountain State. And I think there were just a lot of factors that apparently some of the folks in Charleston clearly underestimated the amount of pushback that they were going to have to go through on this.
Well, and it was just stated that the WVEA president came out to speak to do the press release, and he was booed.
He was booed by the legislature?
Teachers.
By the teachers?
By the teachers. Mm-hmm.
He was booed by... Well, that's kind of remarkable. Why? What would
because
be the explanation
like
for...
Cop-out.
Okay, so... You're thinking is that a common sentiment given what's happened? Because I'm looking at it as fundamentally a tentative success, a victory.
Mm-hmm.
But you're thinking that these folks' leadership has underperformed?
From what I'm seeing from my colleagues, they are very unimpressed with this agreement.
I see. Well, what are the shortcomings that are causing this kind of upset?
Well, here's one comment: is I'm so untrusting of accepting promises of a proven liar and criminal, our governor, promises on which a corrupt legislature has to vote on tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Got a point. These guys are pretty shifty on both sides of the aisle, and
yep.
You know, it's but if the deal can be reached, which is fundamentally the bottom line, if there can be an agreement and both sides fundamentally deal in good faith, we got to come away with it looking as a positive. I mean, no, nobody gets everything that they want, and they may have and based on their experience, they may be justified in being suspicious of what's on the table right now. But the only thing that can be done, as it appears, these decisions have been made to go with. With what's being said is we're just going to have to be vigilant and take a wait and see approach. And if people start misstepping, then hopefully union leadership will know how to act.
Absolutely. You know, people have said to me time and time again, go back to work. And I said, I'm working harder now than I ever did on a school day. We have to be the voice of reason to our legislature. We have to watch them like we have been watching them.
Well, and another thing, too, and I always like to point this out, there are elections coming up. And if the teaching community, the education community, the state employee community isn't happy with Republican or Democrat leadership in Charleston as it may exist now, their choices are clear. Their path is clear. You put in people that are going to be more amenable to your agenda. That's how that works. And these guys need to be paying attention to that. And I'm hoping that on both sides of the aisle, there are folks with long memories as to who was yay and who was nay. And that's how you can fix that as well. So, there's going to have to be some vigilance on that. Ladies and gentlemen, we've been talking with our friend, an educational contributor here for a conservative perspective, Jo Frost. She's been an ear to the ground, a shoulder to the grindstone, her finger on the pulse operative for us, and she's been giving us outstanding information on what has been happening with this, at least here in West Virginia, a remarkably critical issue in terms of state employees, teachers in general in the vanguard on this, but it's a victory for state employees, period, should everybody, be playing nice and do what they're supposed to do instead of being shifty. Joe, I want to thank you once again for being with us. We're down here to the bottom of the hour. We're going to take a little brief musical interlude, and we'll be back with more of a conservative perspective after this. Thank you, Joe. Take good care. See you Thursday.
See you Thursday.
Brethren and sisters, be seated. Gather round me, everybody. Gather round me while I preach some. Feel a sermon coming on in. The topic will be sin, and that's what I'm again. If you wanna hear my story, then saddle back and just sit tight while I start reviewing the attitude of doing right. You got to accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, and latch on to the affirmative. Don't mess with Mr. In-Between. You got to spread joy up to the maximum. Bring gloom down to the minimum. Have faith or pandemonium liable to walk upon the scene. To illustrate my last remark, Jonah in the whale, Noah in the ark. What did they do just when everything looked so dark? With the positive, eliminate the negative, and latch on to the affirmative. Don't mess with Mr. In Between. No, don't mess with Mr. In Between.
Unless she's got a perfect personality. girl can get somewhere in spite of stringy hair or even just a bit bored at the knee. If she can show a faultless personality.
Why are certain girls offered certain things like sable coats and wedding rings by men who wear their spats right?
That's right. So don't you say I'm smart and have the kindest heart. Oh, what a wonderful sister I'd be.
Just tell me how you like my
personality.
Baby, you've got the cutest
personality.
And we're back. James Bostic here. Conservative's perspective on the Patriot Nation Radio Network. God, what a day. You know what? I was just thinking about this thing that Joe was telling us, you know, at the end of the segment we were doing with her. She mentioned that when the AFT Union cats came out, there was some catcalling, there was some booing. And having the brief musical interlude to think about that, I've come to the conclusion that that's really not anything to get excited about. I don't see anything ominous in that, because this is how this stuff works. In my opinion, now the AFT and the WBA union leadership can't crow over this issue. And that was one of the things I wanted to talk to about with Joe, and she seemed to agree. When all this stuff started last week and we couldn't get to any kind of resolution, and the governor was resolute and adamant in his position, as were all the other nays that went on with this. And so what happens? Well, teachers get together and they talk it out. And they, in a very, I thought, considering, you know, how these things work and unions, well, I'm not going to get started on that, but as unions go, I think that AFT and WBA are probably some of the least corrupt and more egalitarian of tradesmen's and professional unions. Nonetheless, what happened was, week before last, there were ballots sent to all the schools in all 55 counties. They were given to faculty. They were given to service personnel alike. And the ballot was simply this. On the front of it, it had yes or no. If it comes down to it in the negotiations, do you authorize these two unions, the West Virginia Educators Association and the American Federation of Teachers, do you authorize the leadership of these two unions, if they say, okay, we're walking out, we're not going to work, you don't go to work, and you honor that. And on the back of the ballot, they wanted you to list your top three concerns, the top three issues that you would have in you know, going with this very serious step of a work stoppage or going out. And overall, what I would say to these folks that were booing is, shut up, you nattering nabobs of negativity. Look, the deal was reached. And if everybody works within reason and are dealing with each other fundamentally honestly, there's going to be some resolutions here. Now, the AFT leadership has reserved the right to say, okay, we don't like what's going on. It's kind of funny. I think we need to take a couple more days off. And this generates leverage on the governor. Now, I would imagine that at some point there's going to be a school of thought. And you heard it here first on Roller Derby, because I'm going to tell you what, I was thinking about this and thinking it even more over what we've seen in 4 days. Now, in 1990, when the strike took place, it was 11 days. I think 11 or 12 days, 11 days. And Raleigh County led the way in that work stoppage as well. And that was a really tense time. 4 days. And what was, like I said, an adamant and resolute governor fundamentally acceded to, you know, just about every one of the, you know, conceded to every one of the union's requests to a degree, to a greater or lesser degree. I think that this is significant. I think that the unions and the leadership, you know, that, like I said, again, they can't really crow about it because as it is now, there's no meat on the plate, so there's not a whole lot to crow about. But that the governor conceded these issues to the extent that he conceded them, when we take into account his previous obstinate position, he wasn't, you know, he was very stubborn about this, and so was the Republican leadership as a rule. And Republican West Virginians, let me tell you something, you need to take a close look at those cats, and you need to look around and see if you can find somebody better. We've got elections coming up, and this must not be relegated to the dustbin of ancient memory when that comes. We need to keep this fresh in our minds. We need to keep these names out there. Okay, yeah, there's a deal, and fundamentally there's victory, and a lot of people are chest bumping and high-fiving, and those are great things. And it's a great thing for teachers and for state employees as a rule. And it's an encouraging first step in pushing back on the medical tyranny that is PIA. So we're gonna look at it as that. We're gonna look at it as a victory. And you guys don't need to be booing. That's just, but emotions are running high on this sort of thing. And there were people on the side of the AFT and the WBA were just as adamant, just as resolute, just as unyielding in their agenda as well. But as we can see, compromise has been reached. These folks have fundamentally, we hope, reasoned together, and they've been able to come out with this. But if you ask me, the only thing that can make this look worse for the governor is to not live up to his part of the agreement. So I think we're going to go ahead and close the book on that. Joe will be back with us on Thursday. And if there are any exciting updates or, you know, further information on this, we're going to bring her in. A lot of admiration for Joe Frost. She's a wonderful lady. And, I'm really grateful that she took the time to do this with us over the last couple of weeks, because seriously, she's been in the forefront of this thing, and she knows the struggle. We haven't heard much more about it, but it's coming out, and you know, the news cycle is a cruel and fickle mistress, and she moves in strange ways, and big stories suddenly become little stories, especially if you have a duplicitous and corrupt media who's going to decide what stories are big and what stories are little. And that's not exactly objective or impartial. And you know what? Just in the interest of disclosure, I'm not impartial either. Says it right there in the daggone name, a conservative's perspective. And that's where I'm coming from, and that's what we're looking at. Constitutionalism, limited government. Don't hit the little guy, that sort of thing. Being an American. And we're going to go back to that because this is serious stuff, and there's more coming out because we're down at the end of February. Sometime, the expectation is in the middle of March, that the Office of the Inspector General will be releasing some pretty heavy information in his report up to this point. And we're, you know what? See, before we go to that, I saw something today on here it is. Attorney General Jeff Sessions confirmed this afternoon that the Department of Justice is opening an official inquiry into the allegations of abuse and anti-Trump bias. This is significant. And anti-Trump bias in obtaining the FISA warrants using DNC-financed material, says that it's going to be investigated. Sessions was speaking with reporters when he announced his agency's plan to get to the bottom of the accusations that were revealed in Representative Devin Nunes' bombshell memo, basically claiming the Obama administration and the Federal Bureau of Investigation used the Clinton-sourced Trump dossier to obtain surveillance warrants against the Trump campaign. Yes, it will be investigated, said the Attorney General, added that it would be the appropriate thing to do following Nunes' four-page document. He went on to say, and this is critical, Michael Horowitz, this is a name that you need to keep in your mind because you're going to hear more of it, and I am very interested to see how historians will record these events and Michael Horowitz's investigation of them. The Inspector General, Sessions went on to say that his Inspector General and the Inspector General for the Department of Justice is Michael Horowitz. He's going to be taking this as one of the matters that he'll deal with. Now, the Department of Justice's investigation comes days after ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff, the Schiff head. He released his rebuttal memo to the Nunes memo, claiming that the FBI was well within its rights, basically, to use this salacious and unverified dossier in their FISA application. Now, again, for those who came in late, this information that was used by the FBI to apply for a surveillance warrant on an American citizen who was a third, fourth tier operative in the Trump campaign. He was a volunteer, higher echelon volunteer, but one of those types. And they used manufactured information. It was produced. It was not researched. It wasn't investigated. It wasn't analyzed. It wasn't disseminated. It was manufactured. It was created out of whole cloth. Now, the thing is, in order to use this information, this manufactured information, this intelligence product, or this opposition research product, because fundamentally that's what it was, the people at Fusion GPS were paid by the Hillary Clinton campaign. They were paid by the Democrat National Committee to go out, dig up dirt. Well, they didn't want to dig up dirt. Apparently now we're talking about work. So they said, well, you know what, just we'll manufacture some dirt. What? Yeah, we'll manufacture some dirt. What do you mean? You mean lie? Yeah? Oh, okay, right. And then off they go, and they do it. And so it's made up. It is sent through a convoluted series of channels. This information goes from a washed-up British rent-a-spy named Christopher Steele, with an E on the other side of Steele, like Remington Steele, Steely. Anyway, so there is an intermediary at the State Department who was a minion of Hillary Clinton's. I think it was Stewart. I'm not sure. Stewart or Kevin. It was one of them. Anyway, so he takes information that the Clinton people and her cabal in the campaign and unofficial advisors, and they send this information through the State Department, through Stewart or Kevin, whichever one it was. And he gives it to Steele, and Steele takes it to Fusion GPS, and he goes over to Russia, and he talks with these people who were either actively working for the Russian Foreign Ministry or formerly KGB operatives who still kind of ran around in Red Square in the Kremlin. So it's made up. But it comes back with the appearance of having been authenticated. It's not, again, salacious, unverifiable. It's you know, it's a boot full of manure. It's all it is. It's nothing. But the problem is, with this manufactured evidence, that the heads at that time, and perhaps now, and higher level functionaries within the Department of Justice and the Federal Bureau of Investigation fundamentally colluded with the Russians. You want to talk about Russian collusion? Let's talk a little bit about Russian collusion, he said, segueing to another article about this stuff. Maybe. Okay, here's the Russian collusion. From our good friend, is it John? Is that you, sport? John Nolte, Breitbart News. It comes down to this for months now. Before the election, immediately after the election, we've heard blah, 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 blah. They've been freaking out, the media has, and this is where the whole Russian collusion thing comes. Donald Trump Jr. took a meeting with a Russian lawyer, and her name was Natalia Veselnitskaya. And I just love saying that. Anyway, in the hopes of getting some opposition research of their own on Hillary Clinton, again and again, we have been told that this is the smoking gun of collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russian government. But it isn't. These guys are savvy businessmen. They're negotiators. They're movers and shakers. Don Sr. did not raise Don Jr. to be no boob. So the boy knows what's going on. And they figured out what was happening here. And basically, that was the end of the meeting. That was the end of the issue. That was the end of the subject. That was the end of that. However, there has been, and I'm getting ready to share it with you, documented actual, real, not fake collusion with Russians as a means to dig up dirt on Donald Trump and the administration. Seven American politicians, institutions who have or are at least suspected of colluding with the Russians as a means to destroy President Trump. Who are we talking about? Well, moment, please. And have to wrap this show up quick. I'm down to the last of the water. The CIA. Although the far-left New York Times is desperately hoping to control the explosion of this bombshell by shrouding it with a laughable story about the Central Intelligence Agency trying to retrieve National Security Agency cyber weapons, they're still forced to report that after months of secret negotiations with the CIA, a shadowy Russian built American spies, built the CIA. He squeezed them for $100,000. And what he had done is he said, well, you know, $100,000, and I can probably get a hold of these National Security Agency cyber weapons. And not only that, to show you that I'm a good guy, I'm going to give you some compromising material on President Trump and you know, no hard feelings. And so this $100,000 was just like a down payment. They were supposed to get this dude $1 million. And what the CIA was thinking that they were going to get, actually, and I'm not making this up, they actually thought that they were going to get pictures of Donald Trump urinating on Russian hookers in Moscow hotel rooms. No, I'm serious. That's what they thought. What they got in reality was a 15-second video clip of some guy in a hotel room talking to some women. Now, they paid this guy $100,000 last September, and he is gone. Back to Adam Schiff, our pal. In early 2017, Democrat Adam Schiff, the ranking member, the head Democrat cheese on the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. So you would think, I know, you would think, and that's almost it. He was under the impression that he was colluding with Ukrainian officials to get, again, compromising materials on President Trump. Well, the Ukrainian officials turned out to be basically the Russian version of John Boy and Billy, and they crank-yanked this guy. So, basically, this idiot Adam Schiff colluded with the Russians to make a horse's ass of himself. Senator Mark Warner, Democrat, Virginia. In March of last year, Mark Warner, the top Democrat on the Senate, not the House, but the Senate Intelligence Committee, fundamentally did the same thing, colluded with a lobbyist from this Russian oligarch that was pals with Putin, a zillionaire, to get dirt on Donald Trump. And he didn't disclose it until 7 months after he had colluded to get this information. He was in fear of being discovered and exposed. So what he did was good. He went ahead and got out in front of it, and he disclosed it to the intelligence committees, and that was the end of it. Again, back to Fusion GPS, Christopher Steele, former spy. In order to compile these lies and this information that was being passed from the Clinton campaign via the State Department through Stewart or Kevin to Christopher Steele, to Fusion GPS, and then on out into the field with these Russian kulaks. Here's what Steele would say in the memos that he filed with Glenn Simpson, the head of Fusion GPS. Source A, to use the nomenclature of what he wrote. Source A was a senior Russian foreign ministry figure. Source B, former top-level intelligence officer still active in the Kremlin. The information comes back that they've been trying to get their hooks into Donald Trump for years. None of it was true. They were saying this stuff because Christopher Steele was offering money, money that came from Fusion GPS, who in turn received it through a law firm, I think, of Parker and Coe. Anyway, they received it from the Democrat National Committee. They received it from the Clinton campaign itself. So in other words, Christopher Steele and Fusion GPS, again, colluded with the Russians to manufacture lies about Donald Trump. Steele then leaked these lies to a complicit media in the hopes of manipulating the outcome of the 2016 presidential election. Fusion GPS also spearheaded the campaign to undo the Magnitsky Act, and that's American legislation imposing sanctions on Russian officials and other figures that are cronies of Vladimir Putin. The work that GPS did on this was basically a smear campaign against William Browder, and he's the financier who was the driving force behind the Magnitsky Act. If they had been successful, this campaign against William Browder would have been of great benefit to the Russian government and the countless oligarchs and the crony capitalists in Russia who want these sanctions lifted. The Hillary Clinton campaign, Hillary's 2016 presidential campaign, hired Fusion GPS to put that dossier together. In other words, the Clinton campaign's paid agents colluded, the paid agents being Fusion GPS, Christopher Steele, because that's where the money went. These paid agents of the Clinton campaign colluded with Kremlin officials to manufacture lies about Donald Trump that would then be leaked to a complicit media in the hopes of manipulating the outcome of the 2016 presidential election. Two more to go. The Democrat National Committee. The DNC hired the DC-based Fusion GPS to put that dossier together in conjunction with the Clinton campaign. In other words, the Democrat National Committee's paid agents in the form of Fusion GPS and Christopher Steele colluded with Russian officials to manufacture lies about Trump that would then be leaked to a complicit media in the hopes of manipulating the outcome of the 2016 presidential election. Finally, the FBI. Our own FBI not only put Steele on the payroll as a confidential informant. This was a guy who colluded with Russians to manufacture lies about Donald Trump. The FBI then used these lies manufactured by Christopher Steele and Boris and Natasha. And they used these lies to obtain the FISA warrants to spy on Trump campaign affiliates. This is serious crap, guys. This is some pretty heavy stuff. Now we're down to the last 4 or 5 minutes, and having said those things about those people, let's talk about treason for a minute. What constitutes treason? Well, if we look it up on Google, treason is the crime of betraying one's country, especially by attempting to kill the sovereign or overthrow the government. The United States Constitution, Article 3, Section 3, has similar words. Treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. The United States Code from 1948 further clarifies and said, whoever owing allegiance to the United States levies war against them or adheres to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort within the United States or elsewhere, is guilty of treason. So based on these three different examples, what are the commonalities? Well, they all three have this in common. Allegiance to the United States is one of the critical elements. So that means U.S. citizens. U.S. citizens who assist their enemies, which would be foreign governments, aiding them and waging war against the United States with the goal of removing the sovereign, meaning the president, or overthrowing the lawful elected government. War in the days of the Constitution was muskets and cannons. Two centuries later, war's a little more sophisticated. Electronic surveillance and fabricated evidence and the use of weaponized government agencies. In other words, it's exactly what was going on before, during, and after the last presidential election. Opposition research by one political party, created by and with the assistance of a foreign entity, had this stuff declared as, quote, valid intelligence by the government of the same party, the Democrats. Then they presented this evidence to a secret court dishonestly, resulting in illegal surveillance of the candidate and the campaign of the opposing political party. These surveillance results were then illegally disseminated to the media, who willingly spread this disinformation far and wide to the entire world. What was the goal? Well, the goal was to subvert the Constitution, the lawful transfer of power from one administration to the next. Having failed that, the conspirators then tried to undermine the sovereign, the president, through accusations and investigations assisted by foreign enemies. This phony dossier, once again described by James Comey, disgraced former FBI Director James Comey, salacious, unverified, was created with the assistance of the Russian government, and it served as the basis of spying on a political candidate and campaign. Well, it didn't happen. 63 million Americans voted for Donald Trump. Well, within 24 hours of her concession speech, the losing candidate cooked up a scheme to blame her loss on Russian interference. Well, the Russians did indeed meddle, mostly after the election, but not to affect the election's outcome, but rather to sow discord within America, as the recent Mueller indictments described. They were assisted by deep staters within the FBI and the Department of Justice, altering testimony, leaking classified information. 90 seconds. Okay, I think you get the idea. These cats, it's treason. And what happens to traitors? Well, in the old-timey days, traitors used to swing for it. And I think we need to get back to that quick. Thank you once again for the opportunity to visit with you and talk a little bit about some of the things that's going on. Once again, special thanks to our friend and educational contributor, Joe Frost, for all the valuable and pertinent information she brought to us. 60 seconds. We're out of here. We will be back next Thursday. We do this live Tuesdays and Thursdays right here on Blog Talk Radio through the studios of the Patriot Nation Radio Network. Thank you once again. We will be back on Thursday taking a look at things, as we do, through a conservative perspective. I'm James Bostic. God bless each and every one of you. God bless America. We'll see you on Thursday.